Hi, everyone. This is Dr. Cheryl Selman, and welcome to What Women Must Know. Thank you for tuning in once again to my wonderful podcast, where we have in-depth conversations that allow you to gain more knowledge, more insight, because I always like to say the purpose of the show is empowering you with truthful information so you can make the most informed decisions possible regarding your health and well-being. And what else is there but to be informed so we can find our way through life? And as always, I have another inspiring conversation in store for you. And if you are listening for the very first time, welcome. I hope you'll be joining me. As you probably know, you can get the archives of all the shows that I do, and you can do that either by going to my Facebook page, which is What Women Must Know, or you can just opt into my website, which is Dr. Cheryl Selman, and then all of those shows will be sent directly to you. And by the way, I have a second show on Progressive Radio Network every Saturday at 11 a.m., but again, it's all archived, so just go to drcherylselman.com, opt in, and you'll get the Love Code Show, which is a very uplifting, transformational, spiritual program. And I think that program is so important these days as well, because we need to be uplifted and stay in our hearts and understand the power we have to heal and transform ourselves. So I hope you'll be joining me on both of my podcasts. And let's talk about today's show. Today we're talking about the day the world stops shopping, which is a sport for so many of us. And my guest is J.B. McKinnon, who has written his latest book called The Day the World Stops Shopping. And a little bit about J.B. He is an award-winning journalist whose work has appeared in The New Yorker, National Geographic, and The Atlantic, as well as the Best American Science and Nature Writing Anthologies. He is also the author of 4 books of nonfiction, including the best-selling Plenty, which is widely recognized as a catalyst of the local foods movement. So we have someone with us today who has a vision, and it's always a pleasure to have these conversations. So I am happy to welcome J.B. McKinnon to the show today. So, J.B., it's so nice to have you. Thank you for joining us.
Pleasure to be here.
So you have this really interesting new book that is really talking about what happens as we, or if we, can change our values and our behaviors that follow. But before we get into that, I am always fascinated by my journeys, by the journeys of my guests. And I want to ask you, tell us a bit about your journey. What is it about you and what caught your attention in your life that has you writing about these topics and really passionate about these issues?
I think, as with most people that you ask that question to, it all goes back to childhood and family and growing up and those sorts of things. And really just the opportunity I had as a child to get out onto the natural landscape in the community I lived in Canada, in Western Canada, and just really developing a strong relationship to that landscape and feeling like the environment wasn't, the in quotes environment to me, it was a part of my community, like my friends and my family. So I went on to become an environmental writer and journalist, and have written on those topics for decades now. What I started to realize was that it didn't really matter what environmental topic I took a look at. When I dug into it, one of the key drivers of that problem was always going to be how much we human beings consume of energy and resources. And that's kind of became the launch pad for this book.
Well, it's an interesting topic, because we have been living in a consumer society for a long time. I mean, if we look at consumer societies, do you have any idea when that started? I was thinking about this topic. As long as television has existed, there have been commercials, right? So I don't know what people did before. Was it billboards, newspapers? But there's always been this drive in a consumer capitalist culture to buy things and to sell things. So that's always been part of our culture, hasn't it? It's just kind of ramped up a bit more these days.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. When did it all begin? And historians and anthropologists have really tried to answer that question in the last 10, 20 years, and they can't really find an answer. I mean, they've gone back as far as, you know, hand axes made by our evolutionary ancestors and found that, you know, they didn't always just make a hand axe. They would sometimes decorate it a little bit too, you know. So there's always been this materialist kind of aspect to human culture. But when you said that, yeah, it's picked up a little bit. I mean, it has accelerated really dramatically, first off throughout the 20th century, but especially in the post-war period. So we came out of the 30s, which was a time of austerity around the world, and then, of course, drifted into a lengthy and awful world war, and people had to live with less again through all of that. And then we got to the end of those wars, and here we were with all kinds of new technologies and capacities to produce goods in abundance and cheaply, and really a world population that was ready for a little consumption, ready for a little materialism. And it took off from there, and we've never really looked back.
So how would you define consumerism?
Consumerism is, I think, a system we live in that is designed around our continuing consumption to maintain it. So when we say that we have a consumer economy, I mean, that's very, very true. It is our consumption that drives the economy. If we want to grow the economy, we need to either find more people to consume, or we need to consume more per person. And over time, kind of everything we do has oriented around that consumer activity. We have a consumer identity. We live in a consumer society. You know, it is the water we swim in at this point.
So, you know, we talked about going back in time. So there's always been trade. You know, people have always been buying and selling things, right? So that's just part of how societies survive, you know, for eons of time. And but what's different now? What's different now in the age that we live in than what has happened in the past?
I think that what's different now is that it's all encompassing. And maybe one way to look at this is to look at how we use time. So we know that in the not too distant past, many of your listeners and I myself can remember the period when in Canada, for example, we had Sunday closing. Many countries around the world had Sunday closing in many communities. So there used to be one day off a week from commercial life and commercial society. We used to not shop on Thanksgiving Day, you know, on Christmas Day. We didn't have online shopping that could pervade our life at any hour of day or night. So, you know, we used to have a more balanced relationship with consumerism, consumption, and this kind of commercial time. And now it's really, you know, it never stops. It really is a 24/7, 365 day a year opportunity to earn and to spend. And we see it in how, you know, the very long hours that people work, and the, you know, the tremendous increases in consumption that we see even over just the last 10, 20 years.
You know, as we're talking, there's just so many avenues to go in my thinking and in our conversation, because there are many dynamics that drive people to shop, right? I mean, there's that is certain needs, there's addictions, there's programming. You know, I think of people who sit all day in front of the Home Shopping Network, you know, and very addictive. I've been there, you know. It's like, oh, my God, I didn't think I needed that, but now I do, right? And just click of a button, and you can do four payments, and it's yours. So there's many levels of why we've gotten caught in this trap and why we've been, in a sense, brainwashed into doing that. If you sit there and use your television as or your computer now and all the things that come at you. So let's unwind, unpack this conversation to look at the many facets of it. Because when you're saying, you know, we need to reevaluate how our society functions and how we use our money to, you know, what we're purchasing and how much. But where would you like to go in this conversation? What is it? What's the message of your book, first of all? What is it that you really want to say to people?
Well, the main message of my book is that we don't have to be doing this. We can. I think a lot of us have started to feel like this is inescapable. And I talk about this in the book as the consumer dilemma that I think a lot of us, most of us, I think at this point recognize that our consumption doesn't seem to be sustainable. I mean, it's doing harm to the climate. It's doing harm to the planet in all kinds of different ways. That aspect of it seems non-negotiable, but at the same time, anytime we slow down our consumption, we see the economy really quickly decline. So, do we have a choice anymore around whether or not to keep shopping was sort of a core question that I wanted to look into. And, you know, I came away with the idea that, yes, you know, we can choose to build a different system and consume less within it. But I think the other aspect of that is, well, who do we become in that process? Who are we at the end of all that? And I think for me personally, that's ended up being at least as important a question as whether or not we can actually do it.
So who do we become? Who do we need to become?
We become, I think, it goes back again to that time question. So I took a look, talked to a lot of psychologists and looked at what the research was that's out there about, you know, what happens if we turn away from materialist values. And when I talk about materialist values, I really just mean values that are focused on possessions and income and status. So we all have materialist values. They are a part of who we are as human beings. It's really just a question of, you know, how much weight do we put on those versus other values. And I was really interested to learn from the research and from the psychologists that it isn't that, you know, focusing on materialism and so on makes us greedy and evil and covetous and, you know, envious and all these things, so much as the fact that every minute that we put into the expression of materialist values is a minute that we could have been putting into something that's more satisfying for us intrinsically, inherently. And so that's, I think, the big question of what direction do we go in if we turn away from consumerism and materialism? There's two ways we can go then. One is to just flounder. We just step into the void and we don't really know what to do with ourselves. And the other is we start moving in the direction of these more intrinsically satisfying values that are built around things like stronger relationships with people we care about, mastering skills, engaging with issues that are larger than ourselves, building relationships with the natural world, these sorts of values that are the alternatives that we're really not investing a lot of time into today, because that's not really the value focus of our society right now.
So when you talk about this kind of movement away from spending our lives accumulating things, and by the way, I just made a big move in my life, and I had to pack everything up. And what I did is actually I gave most of my stuff away. So I gave most of my clothes away. I had a huge library of books, gave my books away, gave, you know, just as much as I could of my stuff, because I realized how much stuff I had. And so it was like lightening the load. And I have to tell you, the more I gave stuff away, the better I enjoyed my space, which got you know, which the, you know, my home just got simpler and simpler. And it just felt so much better to be around less clutter, even though I loved all the stuff I had. But it was amazing how much stuff I accumulated, and knickknacks and clothes that I didn't wear, and just, you know, various things like cupboards full of supplements that I stashed from years before. As a naturopath, I get all these products, and, you know, it's just surrounded by stuff. And I felt quieter. Just felt quieter within myself when things got simpler in my life, with less stuff in my environment. Because it's, you know, stuff is like a frequency, it's like an energy, which is why it's so popular these days to have people, you know, clear out the clutter in one's life, right? They become popular shows, and people are more aware of clearing out the clutter and how you feel as a result. More of a sense of calm and peace inside yourself. And that's based on the whole feng shui model as well. It's like your environment has an impact on you, and you're surrounded by lots of stuff. It's impacting how you think and how you feel and your state of consciousness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the two words that you brought up there were really consistent themes in my work on this book. And so for this book, I wandered around the world. The book does imagine a day that the world stops shopping and then plays out, well, what would happen next in a bunch of different ways, you know, to our environment, to our economy, to our products, and to who we are. But I didn't want it to just be a speculative, you know, fiction, work of science fiction. I wanted to ground it in things that were real. So I went all over the place and I talked to people in different parts of the world, and a lot of them were living lower consuming lifestyles in one way or another. They were practicing voluntary simplicity and things like this. And two of the words that you mentioned came up a lot as themes, and one is space and the other is quiet. Space was expressed in all kinds of different ways. Sometimes people moved away from owning more possessions to give themselves financial space. You know, they managed to, by not buying as many things, they would manage to clear debt and sort of take that burden off themselves. Or they would, as you said, kind of clear their actual physical space and feel that lightness that you described so well. They would be talking about quiet in the sense of wanting to be able to hear themselves more clearly through the noise of consumer culture. And one thing I found really interesting about this was that people would tend to, it was one of the things they feared about going down this path, was that they feared that it was going to be quiet, too quiet and uncomfortably quiet and maybe boring and dull. And instead, what most of those people I spoke to found was that they wanted more and more of it as they headed in that direction. And you know, I experienced that myself during the pandemic when I've been thinking about these things a lot after writing the book. And when the quarantines happened and the lockdowns happened, there was that opportunity to actually really just sit with yourself and your thoughts and reflect and think about your values and your priorities and things like that. Or you could go online and start streaming television programs for 14 hours a day. And I opted not to sign up for any subscription streaming, almost as an experiment, just to see what that would feel like. And what I found was, you know, I was rewarded with an opportunity to really dwell in quiet and all of the good things that can come from that.
Yeah, that's beautiful. You know, it's an interesting time because I've talked to so many people, and some people chose to do the path that you just described, and some people chose to do the path of being bored and just watching Netflix or Home Shopping Network, whatever. And it has different consequences. And, you know, when I'd like to hear more of what you learned as you traveled around the world, but I just want to make the comment as a psychotherapist and observing human behavior. Everything that we have in our culture right now has been a programming. We've been programmed. We've been programming to want more stuff. We've been programmed to buy. And I think home shopping networks are such a prime example that, you know, they're enticing us. We feel good. We, you know, something that looks good and makes us feel good. And it goes back to the fact that that for so many of people in our culture, we have an underlying wound, an underlying unhappiness that we think will be filled with stuff. And so we have this temporary high that comes from ordering something or getting something in the mail. And it really has to be addressed, because if we're going to stop consuming, we have to really look at ourselves, and we have to really look at what this addiction to stuff is really hiding us from.
Mm-hmm.
And it's such a big story, JB, really. You know, it's not just about changing a behavior of buying less. You have to also change the wound inside you that you think will be filled up by, you know, by the process of owning or buying more stuff or showing off with more stuff. So it's a deep, deep psychological and spiritual wound, I think, that has to be looked at, because you were able to sit quietly and use that time to observe yourself and to go more deeply into yourself. Others chose to disconnect from what they were feeling in their discomfort and just, you know, stuck on to their Netflix or just used it as an opportunity to take advantage of all the sales that they were being presented with. So it's so deep, right? It's so deep and complex. Mm-hmm. A process of what has gotten us to this place of consumerism.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think the things you described, that sense of our having been programmed, I mean, that's tightly related to people's anxiety about spending time with themselves, or, you know, as you say, kind of going to the roots of what we're trying to fill when we fill our homes with things. The programming aspect is, you know, that's one of the things that I certainly found is very much true. I mean, there are powerful forces that compel us to consume. We start as children and we go through our lives faced up against, you know, $600 billion advertising industry globally. There's as you say, the TV shopping channels, there's lifestyle media as a whole, which is enormous and you know, is reality TV and lifestyle media are essentially the same thing at this point. And then, you know, if we do slow down our shopping, as we saw in the pandemic or we've seen in past recessions, then all the stops are pulled out by government to try to get us back to the mall. I mean, world leaders will ask us to do it. They will cut checks and send them to us, as we're seeing now in the United States, to, you know, to get people back to spending. We really should be pretty compassionate with ourselves around the fact that we do all this consuming, because there's a lot of, there are these powerful forces that are, you know, urging us to do it all the time. The result of that has been that we're not very good at living along the lines of the other values. We're very good. We're very sophisticated consumers. We're very good at navigating the world of materialist values. And when we turn away from those, we're not necessarily as practiced and as skilled in navigating the world of these more inherently satisfying values. And you saw this in the pandemic with people. Yeah, they suddenly really couldn't participate in consumer culture, and you did see people turn towards reaching out to friends and family that they hadn't spoken to for years on, you know, video platforms and things like this. You saw people trying to master skills like, iconically, you know, baking sourdough bread loaves. You saw this sharp turn towards these different values. You saw tremendous engagement in issues larger than the individual, the Black Lives Matter movement, climate strikes, and things like this. But you also saw people lose confidence in their ability to navigate that world. And as soon as the as soon as the consumer economy reoriented itself and made delivery available and, you know, streaming available and you know, offered us all of these opportunities to reengage with the consumer economy, you know, many of us did make that turn back to what we know and what we do well.
So what are some of the, I see this in kind of this conversation in two parts. One of them is a very practical thing. What, you know, when the world stops shopping, this world that you've imagined, what is it that you would like to present as possibilities of how to either reduce the amount of the unnecessary things we are attracted to and buy, or how it can be presented in a way that when we do consume, it's in a more conscious way?
Well, there's two levels that I think about that at coming out of this book, and one is the system level, and one is more the level of the individual consumer. And so, we have opportunities. Maybe I'll start with the individual. I mean, I think there are all kinds of good reasons that a person might want to reorient their, you know, their life and their values towards these more inherently satisfying values. And it's something that spiritual leaders in particular have been talking about for as long as there have been spiritual leaders, right? I mean, just try to live according to a different set of values. Try not to be consumed by possessions, by your status. You know, don't covet your neighbor's things, all of those sorts of messages. And I think that is really attractive to some people, and in history has been quite attractive at times to pretty large numbers of people. But it's very difficult for us as individuals to run up against the scale of system that we're in today. And so I look also at, well, how can we start to change aspects of the system itself so that we don't feel as compelled to consume? And there, on that front, I mean, I think a simple example, one that I look to fairly often, is the idea of moving away from this trend towards more and more disposable products and instead thinking about how we can get back towards more durable products and products that we keep and hang on to and love and cherish for a long period of time. And there are very, really practical things we can do to make that happen. We can mandate that products be made repairable. We can ask for lifespan labels on products. Raise a clamor at businesses that we buy from and ask them to make a shift towards a product of a business model in which people are buying fewer things but better things. There's things governments can do to encourage a shift towards durable products. These kinds of changes at the system level are available for, you know, really anything we want to look at within consumer culture, from advertising to what is our social role in day-to-day life in a city or town.
So is there an example of where this is happening, or is this just a vision that you hold?
No, I mean, each of these things is happening somewhere. It's just that I wouldn't say not all of them are happening anywhere. You do see countries that limit advertising directed at children, for example. You do see France has a national law against planned obsolescence or the design of a product so that it's designed to fail. They have an actual law, and if you can take a company to court and say, hey, you designed this so that it's, you know, my phone battery would die, or you designed this printer so that it would give out after 120 print jobs and you didn't let me know that was the case, then you can actually, you know, those companies can get pretty significant fines. One of my favorite solutions that I looked into while I was researching this book was a thing called the Participatory City in It's in a borough outside of London, England, and they've organized what they call shops, but they're not ordinary shops. If you walk into one of these things, instead of being met with products for sale, you're met with dozens and dozens of opportunities to participate in your community, to learn from members of your community, and it's all free. So it's the world's largest experiment right now in participatory culture. It's been going on for about 3 years, and it envisions a different role for us, a different day-to-day role, one in which we share our skills, one in which we engage with the people in our neighborhood and our community a lot more and perceive ourselves as consumers a lot less. So there are, around the world, there are a lot of exciting things happen, but there is no one place that is shifting off of the current model of a consumer economy, consumer society.
I love that story of what they're doing in that borough in the UK, because it kind of gets to the heart of the matter, doesn't it, JB? You know, if you can create a community where you're engaged, where there's things you want to do, or you're supported, or you're excited, looking forward to learning new things, or being part of something that's inspiring, you'll leave your favorite recliner chair and go and be with people and do things and learn, which is really, I think, what is part of the problem. We've isolated ourselves and disconnected ourselves. And it's so easy just to plop into your favorite chair and turn on the TV or your computer. Yeah. and get involved in your own little world, as opposed to living with this excitement of learning and sharing and being part of something bigger than yourself.
Yeah, and that participatory culture experiment was, for me, one of the most moving experiences I had in researching this book, because the folks who are doing this, the Participatory City Foundation in the UK, they didn't make it easy for themselves. They didn't pick sort of a wealthy suburb where a lot of people have leisure time or anything like that. They picked one of the poorer boroughs in the London area. And one of the things that really struck me when I was there was that, you know, when I ask people, well, you're participating in all these interesting activities, what would you be doing if you weren't doing this? And, you know, probably from my orientation that I brought to this book, I just thought, well, these people would be, they'd be consuming, they'd be shopping, they'd be going off and enjoying distractions and entertainments or whatever. Instead, what I heard was they wouldn't be doing anything, because a lot of them weren't earning a lot of income. And what you realize in a place like that is that if you're not earning a lot to spend in a consumer culture, then there's not a lot to do. And you're kind of shut out of the core thing that we're all doing in this society. And so for these people to suddenly have opportunities to participate and get to know one another and learn things and do things was really affecting to hear from them about how much it was changing their world. I remember one woman in particular who was telling me that she had, she had feared at times walking down the streets, and she described walking down one street and seeing, kind of what she would perceive as hoodlums, kind of coming towards her and getting fearful and anxious and thinking about, should she cross the street? And then she realized that she recognized all of those young people from a community potluck that had been held in the borough. And, they greeted her by name and she said hello. And, you could see in her face how dramatic a moment that was for her in terms of the transformation of her community and her role in it.
Yeah. What's happening with that model? Is it being taken up by other people and other places? Is it presented so people can become aware of it and learn from it?
Yeah, they're tracking it really closely and sort of trying to understand how it's growing and what people are getting from it, and those sorts of things. And there are other parts of the world, including a couple of communities in Canada, actually, who are setting up to try a similar kind of experiment. That said, the pandemic brought participatory culture to something of a grinding halt. I mean, it really had to move online, and it hasn't been able to play out as imagined, although I think it remained a community that was strong in the sense that it was tightly connected, even though it had to be virtually. But it hasn't been, the pandemic hasn't, it did slow down the opportunity to really see how that model works in real life. And so I think as we come out of it, there'll be the opportunity to learn more.
Well, it really inspires me to hear this story because it just gets to the heart of the matter. When you are part of a community and you are supported and you are feeling valued and learning and growing, you are so much more willing to be a part of it, leave behind the addictive watching of TV or consuming of things, because you are really being nourished and nurtured on a deep soul level, which is what humans really require. We really require connection and being valued and being part of the community. And I think so much of what has caused so much pain and suffering is how we have been so disconnected in our culture. I've traveled around the world. I've been to India, and I've been to Costa Rica, and I've been to Malaysia, and I've just, I've been to many cultures, and you really see how beautiful it is when people are part of a community and support each other and grow together and dance and cook and laugh and, just know the people in your community. And so when we're disconnected, we have to do something to really numb the pain of being disconnected.
Yeah, and again, that's a really interesting point, because one of the things I looked at was that question of, are there other parts of the world where people are consuming considerably less, but are not, but whose well-being is at least as good as ours, and I found that there are such places, and the one that I ended up visiting is the nation of Ecuador, which is a small country in South America, and it has the average Ecuadorian's consumption is considered to be sustainable in a global sense in terms of environmental impact. So they are consuming at a rate at which, if everyone on Earth consumed like the average Ecuadorian, we'd be able to make do with the resources we have on the planet today. But at the same time, they are rated a highly developed nation by the United Nations. So, countries like the United States and Canada and Australia and Western Europe, they're rated as very highly developed nations. So they are, different in terms of their scale of development, but a highly developed nation is a highly developed nation. It has a good standard of healthcare and education and good quality of life. And yet they're doing so at so much lower a rate of consumption. And they have this whole idea there of buen vivir in Spanish, which doesn't really translate to anything directly, but is essentially the idea of living well or of well-being, and trying to pursue that, despite the fact that the nation is living at a lower level of consumption. And I spoke to people about that, and I mean, most people agreed that if they were at that kind of average consumption level, their lives were good. they had community. They had the big picture issues weren't a concern. They did have access to education. They did have access to healthcare, those sorts of things. And to the extent that they were concerned about how much stuff they had and how wealthy they were and things like that, the main issue there was their awareness of these richer nations, where people were, you know, people are on television consuming at extraordinary rates, and they're aware of those things, and it you know, makes them wonder whether they have quality of life. But, you know, certainly from where I stood talking to them, it looked like they very much did.
So can you share a little bit more about what they are, what that culture in Ecuador is doing that makes them, you know, sustainable but less consumerism driving the culture?
Well, I mean, it really is just that economy is not as strong. It's a, you know, it's a poorer nation, but it is much better at translating what it has economically into well-being than Canada is, or the United States is, or, you know, Western Europe is, because they, you know, even though they aren't able to buy as many things, they rank quite highly on in terms of happiness, and they have this very high level of, or this high level of development. So what they're doing differently is translating their national income into quality of life and well-being much more efficiently than we are in the West.
Yeah, you don't need stuff to be happy. It's a culture that has many more crafts, and people are making things. You know, as you're talking, it reminds mm-hmm. me of Bhutan. So I was supposed to be going to Bhutan last year, but obviously, you know, everything is shut down. But it's a fascinating culture, and I was really looking into Bhutan. You know, it's the only truly pure Buddhist country in the world. Everything in that country is based around the values of Buddhism. And up until very recently, they didn't have much TV. And I'm not sure when TV was even introduced. So for a long time, in the 20th century, they maintained their culture and maintained their values. They didn't have the outside influence. And then they brought TV in, and they brought the cable TV in, and they brought the U.S. programmings in. And it was really interesting what was happening to the youth in that culture, by the way. They started to mimic what they saw on these American programs with violence. You know, it wasn't a culture really based on any source of violence, and suddenly all their teenagers were wanting to imitate guns, and they became more violent, and they started wearing jeans and wanting to get more into the darker side of life, to be honest. They found there's a problem with crime and prostitution, which they never really had in Bhutan. I think it's a really good example of what happens when we allow these influences into our psyche and how it changes us and transforms a culture. And actually, I think they've cut back on what programs they're allowing into Bhutan right now, because they were really concerned what was happening to the youth there.
Yeah, I spoke to an anthropologist who had looked at how consumer culture moves into indigenous cultures around the world. And it was really interesting, because he said, well, you know, people are adopting aspects of sort of Western style consumer culture into their cultures. Some places are doing it very selectively. Some places are doing it very slowly, others a little more quickly. But he said that the biggest predictor of whether or not it was going to move quickly and be disruptive in a culture or not was whether or not that culture was in a state of increasing dislocation and rootlessness and material and financial insecurity. So, you know, if people were being displaced from their land or things like that, they were much more likely to move more quickly into a consumer, you know, set of consumer values like the ones that that we know so well. And I just thought, well, you know, as much as that may apply to cultures, I think it very much applies to us as well. And it struck me that dislocation and rootlessness and insecurity is precisely what consumer culture sells to us. It's what it creates. So it has become a machine that creates the conditions in which we are disturbed in a way that we become attracted to it. And I think, you know, I can see that at every level, from, you know, from the cultural to the individual to the global at this point.
And as you're sharing that, it just brings me back to the teachings of Buddhism and many of the other spiritual wisdoms, that we try to make the outside world give us peace and happiness. So we externalize all the time, whereas we really can only find that by going within and finding our connection to the true source of who we are. So the more we try to find that happiness outside, and the more things we have to have, it's like it's a never-ending cycle of frustration and despair, because we can never find it by things. And we have to ultimately understand the true source of happiness, which is what we're trying to attain by things, is only found by connecting inside to our greater truth or to our spiritual essence. So it's a, you know, it's a profound conversation that has many facets to it. And in the time we have left, JB, what are some of the strategies that you would like to offer to my audience? Maybe some challenges in dealing with the consumer world, or just thoughts you want to leave with people to consider how they're choosing to live.
Well, I think there's two things I'd say. And the first one is that in my experience and coming out of the research I did for this book, I think the first thing I'd say is that we need to be kinder to ourselves about our consumption. I think a lot of people beat themselves up about it, feel guilty about it, feel like, you know, if they are concerned about the environment, they feel like an environmental criminal every time they put in a tank of gas, these sorts of things. I think it's really important for us to understand that this is a system. It has been built over 250 years. It has all of these powerful forces at play, and it shouldn't shock us to realize that we are consumers in a consumer society. So I think that's the first thing I'd say. The second thing I'd say is that I think there's a tendency when we talk about reducing consumption or reducing materialism to think about it as giving things up. And I think the better approach is to think about, well, what can I gain? You can gain, you will, if you make time and space in your life for quiet, for calm, for trying to investigate, you know, your own being, thinking about what is your authentic self, you know, you need room to do that kind of thing. And if you make that room, then that's time that you're going to be spending not participating in consumerism, and that will automatically draw down your consumption and its effects on you and its effects on the planet. And I think, again, in terms of things you can gain that time to work on getting better at relating to the people you care about and relating to your community, dedicating time to causes larger than yourself, dedicating time to, you know, just getting down and swimming in that local lake that you know makes you feel good. And if you start going down this path, people tend to, as one psychologist said, people will come to the simple life through all kinds of different doorways, but once they get in, it's all the same house. And that seems to be very true. People will come to a simpler approach to life from all kinds of different paths, but once they're there, they will tend to continue moving in the same direction. So those are two key things, and I think that maybe the third one I would throw in is just that we can think about this as a system. It's something that we can demand. It's something that we can think about as business people, as citizens, as parents, as you name it. We can start to think about how we can approach consumption differently and what we can ask from from our communities and our leaders and so on, what we can ask to be done differently.
Yes, it's really a big question to address within oneself. When I was decluttering, and I think that's another strategy, by the way, that people may consider, is really look into decluttering your space. Because when you do that, I think people discover how much stuff they've accumulated and they don't need. And it's a bit of a shock to learn that, mm-hmm. to see just how much we have, even almost unconsciously, we discover things that we have stored away that we didn't even know we had, and how much space it takes up in our home, if not our consciousness, right? So, yep. So when I was clearing out my stuff, I had a revelation that if everyone would clear out their stuff, and they would take all the stuff that they've cleared out and had a big gathering, and people brought their stuff, you would find anything that you required from someone else's pile of stuff. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You never have to go shopping anymore. You could find clothes. You can find appliances, things that people don't need or use anymore. And if everyone just brought all their stuff out into the open and you can go around and choose what you want, you'd get the satisfaction of finding a treasure without having to pay for it if we just shared our stuff. And I think that, I don't know, it's really, to me, it's really profound, because it would break the cycle of going and having to spend money to shop, but we could have the pleasure of shopping by just finding the treasures from other people's stuff that they don't need anymore.
Yeah, there's all kinds of networks to do that kind of thing online now as well. It's a lot easier than it used to be to offer and give away your things. And I do think those sorts of personal experiments can be really enlightening. Decluttering, I think, can be effective that way, and sharing things, as you said, or declaring, some people declare personal Sabbaths. They just say, well, you know, there's going to be a day each week that works for me, that I'm not going to purchase anything, and I'm just going to participate in non-commercial life one day a week and use that time to tap into things. So there's lots of different things people can try.
And I think that's what's so special about having this conversation today, because it's giving people something to think about. You know, we're re-examining our lives, re-examining where our values are, how to live in a way that is much more satisfying, or just do those little experiments with ourselves. You know, how do we feel when we have a day off from shopping, or a day off from being on our screen? What does that feel like? What does it bring up in us? And that's self-discovery, right? It's a way to really start looking into one's being and growing and healing. Just, you know, there's a saying that I always used to use in my psychotherapy practice. You know, if you do what you've always done, you'll get what you've always gotten. So anytime you make a little change in anything, you have a new perspective on things. You have new possibilities opening up. So we have to get out of our habits and explore new ways, because we will always learn. We'll always learn something about ourselves.
Yeah.
So
and all of that growth,
conversation.
Yeah, all of those sorts of things grow the conversation as well, which I think is so exciting, because it's been quite a long time since consumption and consumerism were front and center in the public conversation, and I think the time is now to bring it back.
Yeah, well, this has been a fascinating conversation, JB, I have to say, and the fact that you traveled around the world and got to experience different experiments in different cultures, in different way that people are living their lives is so refreshing. It's inspiring. It's uplifting to see that there are, you know, ways that we could be choosing to live and relate to each other that we probably don't do in our everyday life, but maybe it'll inspire someone to do it, to, you know, initiate something. So that's what it's about. It's this conversation that opens up new ideas. So let's go back to your book. So if people want to learn more about The Day the World Stops Shopping, they can go to your website, which is jbmackinnon.com. Anything else we need to know about getting the book and contacting what you're doing, getting in touch with you? What would you like to share?
Well, I'm reachable through the website, and there's all kinds of ways to access the book through the website as well. Of course, it's available in bookstores in real life and online, and of course, it's widely available at libraries for those who have already stopped shopping.
And do you have the next project happening?
Right now, I'm just really caught up in a fortunate way with the welcome reaction to this book. It does seem like it's striking a chord with a lot of people, particularly coming out of the pandemic. So I've been having a lot of wonderful conversations like this one and hearing from all kinds of people around the world.
Yeah, that's great. Well, congratulations on your latest book, The Day the World Stopped Shopping, and encourage people to go visit you on your website, jbmckinnon.com, to learn more and to open to the possibility of what happens if we don't go shopping all the time and find more wisdom and value in our lives. So all the best to you, JB. Thank you for being with us today. And I want to thank all my listeners for tuning in again to another opportunity to have these great conversations on What Women Must Know. And until next time, I always like to say, honor the wisdom of your feminine self. Bye for now.